The attorneys at Gingrich, Thompson, and Wachs have had the honor of receiving numerous awards for their work both in and outside the courtroom. But just as important as receiving accolades for being skilled attorneys, it's equally important to give back to the community in which they live and work. If you want a personal attorney that can help you in so many different areas, they've got them. They're in Eau Claire, Madison, Milwaukee, and Waukesha. They're easy to reach. GTWLawyers.com. That's GTWLawyers.com.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at the Operating Engineers Local 139 and Madison Teamsters Local 695. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. John, here's a little setup of what happened on Super Tuesday. I don't know if you know, we just had Super Tuesday. I'm pretty sure you were paying attention. Here we go.
Joe Biden today is relishing his stunning comeback.
Look, we're going to bring together all Americans. We did that. We showed that last night.
The former vice president swept 10 out of 15 Super Tuesday contests, including upsets in Minnesota and even Texas.
They don't call Super Tuesday for nothing.
He also won two states in Bernie Sanders' backyard, Massachusetts and Maine.
And we're told, well, when he got to Super Tuesday, it'd be over. Well, it may be over for the other guy.
An establishment of all those hard-working middle-class people, those African-Americans, those independent
Today, the best week of Biden's campaign got even better.
And I'm glad to say I endorse Joe Biden, and I hope you will join me in working to make him the next president of the United States of America.
Michael Bloomberg poured more than $500 million into his campaign, only to win just one contest, American Samoa. Dropping out today, he pledged to keep his checkbook open to help defeat President Trump.
I will not be our party's nominee, but I will not walk away from the most important political fight of my life, and I hope you won't walk away either.
Bloomberg's exit came as news to Sanders.
Well, it's the first I heard about that. He certainly brought a lot of money into this race. I suspect we will see, a lot of money coming into Biden's campaign. Probably a lot of negative ads attacking me.
Sanders winning Utah, Colorado, and his home state of Vermont, and he's leading in California. But today, he was blunt.
Of course I'm disappointed. I would like to win every state by a landslide. It's not going to happen. What we are trying to do is unprecedented, all right? We are talking about a political revolution.
Some Sanders supporters are turning up the heat on Elizabeth Warren to drop out and endorse her fellow progressive. But Warren's team says the Massachusetts senator is taking time to assess. She and Sanders spoke this morning.
It is important, I think, for all of us to respect the time and the space that she needs to make her decision.
Mayor, turn now to the fireworks at the Supreme Court.
We are now in an actual race for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States.
Oh, we weren't before?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
Now, what you had before was kind of a preparation, if you will. And that's not to diminish it. It was hugely significant. But you had the better part of 2 years of people positioning for when the voting began, right? And the voting has begun. The interesting thing is that as this process has gone on, what have we seen? The rapid exit of candidates, right? These people who had prepared and positioned ready for this moment, you know, and all the theories of when they would take off, what would happen. I think some people actually left the race before they should have, which, by the way, I think is affecting the thinking of Elizabeth Warren now. It's like, you know, this is such a wild race that you don't jump out, you know, until you're really sure you should. But bottom line is candidates left after, you know, very rapidly as the voting began because the thing was becoming real. And what I mean by becoming real is that it extends beyond a small state where you can literally sleep on people's couches or, you know, knock on their doors and do, you know, the equivalent of a state Senate campaign, right? Now we're in a presidential race, and that's what I mean. Suddenly, we've got states voting all over the country, and instead of the traditional models, you know, of, again, the knocking on the doors and that, all the organizing, you have this instantaneous overlay of national media, and it doesn't stop. You know, people think, wow, you just had Super Tuesday. Now maybe we'll go back to a kind of a more normal pattern. No, you're not. Look at what's coming next Tuesday and the Tuesday after. You know, these are great big states in different parts of the country with massive numbers of delegates. So effectively, that's what I'm saying. Now we are in a presidential race, which in many ways mirrors a fall race. You know, it's as much about talking to national media as it is talking about, you know, media in a battleground state. You know, this is the last thing I'll say, and it's just, but understand this. You know as well as I, in a fall election, there are a handful of battleground states. They get overwhelming attention, and the candidates, you know, go to them a lot. They hold rallies in them. They talk to the media there, but then they also talk over to the national media to reach those. That's what we're in. That's where we're at now.
All right, here is Bernie Sanders on Last Night with Rachel Maddow.
You are off to what I know is going to be a big string of events and heavy-duty campaigning over the next week. The states next week look good for you. I think Mississippi is going to be a reach, but the other states that are in competition next week, places like Missouri and Michigan, you fought basically to a tie. Or Michigan, you won.
It was very close. Won by a little bit in Michigan.
It was very close in Missouri. Yeah. You did great in Idaho and Washington, places like that. How do you feel about what's ahead and momentum? And how strong your opponent, Vice President Biden, is right now?
Well, look, Joe Biden is a very strong opponent. He will have all of the corporate world behind him. He'll have the political world behind him. But this is what we're going to do, Rachel. And I got to tell you, you know, I hope very much this doesn't come into some kind of ugly personal attacks, because I like Joe Biden. He's a very decent guy. But what is important for us is to contrast our record, our vision for the future with Joe's. And that's what we're going to do. Joe Biden voted for the war in Iraq. I led the opposition against that disastrous war. That's the difference. Joe Biden voted for a bankruptcy bill on behalf of the credit card companies, and that bill has done a lot of harm to working families all over this country. I voted against it. We're going to the Midwest, Michigan. Michigan was decimated by a terrible, terrible trade deals. NAFTA, PNTR with China, which cost our country some 4 million good-paying jobs. I walked the picket lines against NAFTA. I went to Mexico to see what NAFTA would do. Joe voted for those terrible agreements. I have spent my life fighting against cuts for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Check it out. Joe was on the floor of the Senate talking about the need to cut Social Security, Medicare, veterans' needs. Joe voted for the Wall Street bailout. I was disgusted by that bailout. So the differences are enormous, and our vision for the future are enormous. And I hope very much we'll have a straight-up debate over our records, what we've tried to accomplish, and where we want this country to go.
As I watched Rachel's face, and it was not a friendly interview. She gives the appearance of a friendly interview, but it was actually a very sharp exchange in moments. She was very... very rough on him. I could see her eyes glazing over. I don't really think that had an impact on her, John.
You don't?
No, I really don't.
Well, there you go. Look, I have yet to meet many people in national media. This is in cable, you know, big papers, other settings, who take the issue of trade seriously. This is a multi-generational reality now. It goes back to the 1930s, or 19, I apologize, going back a little further than I should there, going back to the 1990s. And I've really, you know, I've written about it in books. I've discussed it in all sorts of settings. You and I have discussed it many times. If you'll recall, when NAFTA was in play, when we did our research on that, of the 1,700 daily newspapers in the United States, as best we could figure, two, maybe three of them opposed NAFTA, despite the fact that polling showed, you know, it was pretty much an even split nationwide. Most Democrats in Congress opposed it, and many Republicans. And so our media just doesn't get
What would those two newspapers have in common?
I work for them.
The Toledo Blade and the Capital Times.
That is true.
Okay.
And it's an incredible imbalance. It actually is more severe than what we had going into the Iraq War, as an example. And so we have a really, really huge breakdown in how media approaches this fundamental issue, this still fundamental issue. And the reason it's still fundamental, even though so many factories have closed, 60,000 factories, right, across the country closed, you know, in this free trade era, you know, whole towns devastated. And you've seen it. We all know it's real. People don't have to just look at the data. They can open their eyes. Even though that reality is there, media still doesn't cover it. But
yeah, you know, really, all you have to do, go to the Salvation Army in Freeport, where they serve lunch every day, and sit down and talk to people. I've done it.
Oh, I know. And so have I. And when Ed Schultz was around, we actually did some stuff on it over the years back at MSNBC in those days. And that was really quite important. It was a bit of a breakthrough. And there have been other breakthroughs along the way. There are individual reporters and individual commentators who've taken it seriously. But generally, it's because they have roots in a place that was hard hit. The overall reality is that's not how it plays. So, you can't pick on Rachel Maddow there, right?
I can pick on her.
You may want to, but what I'm going to tell you is you could put anybody in that chair, right? And Sanders is going to get
I think Chris Hayes understands it a little more.
He understands it. I agree, but I still don't think that it's quite the passion.
No.
You know, and this is what I'm talking about. I cannot begin to emphasize that in a lot of America, it's a passion. And do you know who figured that out in about 2 minutes? Donald Trump. Right? What did Trump do? He lied to people. But, boy, I mean, his reaction to, especially the classic example, the Carrier plant in Indiana, was, we're not going to let that thing close. Right? And you know, he talked about how he saw video of people crying when they heard, you know, like longtime employees crying when they heard that their jobs are going to be outsourced. Trump, you know, recognized it, talked about it, made it a part of what he was doing in his campaign.
It's how he became president.
It's very effective. And yet, our media, by and large in this country still, is, you know, how did that happen? You know, what we got to study this. No, the stuff is writ large. And so now you're going to have this interesting circumstance where Sanders is going to try to fight a fight. And I think he runs risks here, by the way, because if he doesn't keep his message clearly focused, if he isn't really, you know, strong on this, it will be harder. But if he does keep his message focused, if he is strong on it, he's going to try to make some of these upcoming votes in Ohio and Michigan, ultimately perhaps Wisconsin, trade-based, you know, about, you know, genuine policy. That's not an attack on Joe Biden. That's just discussing a fundamental reality of our politics and of our governance. We'll see how far he gets, though. It's going to be hard.
Well, Biden has already been backpedaling on the TPP.
Oh, on everything. You know, suddenly you're going to find out that Biden did cast a couple of good trade votes in, like, the 2000s, you know? They're like, after voting for NAFTA and WTO and China free trade and all these things. You know, he'll emphasize the two that he didn't get wrong or the three that he didn't get wrong. Biden's not stupid, and neither are his strategists. They know they're going now into a difficult situation. So they're going to want to have this whole race be about everything else. And they're going to especially want, the Biden people are going to want it to be about that magic word, electability. And so here's the final subtlety of what's going to happen now. And it's an interesting test. And it is the place that I think will be, it's the measure that will be very important going into a place like Michigan and then the other states. Does Sanders effectively link his trade stances to the electability argument? Now, if he didn't do it well last night in that interview with Rachel Maddow, Sanders did not do that well. And if he doesn't do it well on the trail, I'm not sure that he will hit the effectiveness that he has to. What he needs to do is to say, in my view, if I'm just looking at it from as how politics, I think, works in these places, he needs to say, we're going to be making trade policy from now until 100 years from now. It's going to continue to be a reality, and you have to have a certain set of values that you go into that on. People know my values, and I can go right up against Donald Trump in November of 2020 and take my record and take his record as president and beat him, right? I can beat him. And so it has to be emphasizing the trade policy, emphasizing the differences with Biden, but then taking it that last step of saying, and this is critical to the 2020 election.
All right, we'll take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SliceOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SliceOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SliceOffice.com.
We're back at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works, also the law firm of Gingras, Thompson, and Wachs. All right, John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation with us. This was an interesting Super Tuesday. In a 72-hour period, the whole tenor of the race changed. I've never seen anything like it. It's one of the most remarkable things in the world. Biden has clearly put a coalition together of suburban voters and African-American voters. If you were to give advice to Bernie Sanders on how to combat that, what would you say?
Biden has a history of stumbling when things are going well for him, when he seems to be taking off. And so one of the things that's important to do is not spend too much time attacking Biden, right? Let Biden be Biden. He may do great. He may put it all together, and then that's just going to be the case. But don't assume that somehow a negative campaign is going to make everything work. The better thing, in my view, is a very, very smart issue-focused campaign that will, at times, cause you to point out where you disagree with Biden and emphasize why that relates to electability, things like that. But it also has another thing. And that is to make voters like you, to make voters feel good about you and feel like this is the person they'd like to vote for in November. But for Sanders, that's a really important part of this because there's going to be a tremendous effort to marginalize him, right, to push him to the edges and to use every cliche about him to say that he is,
A communist.
And just, but also that he rants and raves, that he's angry, that he's gruff, all sorts of stuff like that. And so the likability factor really comes into play here. And also the self-promotion, the literally talking about what your record is, who you are, why you would be a good candidate. And I'll give you a quick example as regards another candidate on this thing. If you look at Super Tuesday, it's a pretty rough day for Elizabeth Warren. Despite the fact that she had a pair of really good debates prior to that, right? And so you say, well, why didn't those debates yield tremendous benefit for Elizabeth Warren in Nevada, in South Carolina, and in the Super Tuesday states? Because she was, across the board, generally viewed as the winner of those debates. Well, because so much of her energy in those debates went into taking down another candidate, Mike Bloomberg.
And right? God, and bless her heart.
Good credit to her for that.
Right.
But.
Yeah, that was almost like a kamikaze run, though.
Well, it goes to my point here politically. You have to, find to distinguish yourself from another candidate, especially if it's based on issues. But you also got to make your own case, right? You have to pivot to your own case. And I think that take the lesson there from what happened with Warren. And for Sanders, that's an important lesson. It's a really important lesson. If you spend too much time trying to take down your rival. It is possible that you do take your rival down some, but boy, if you don't 100% succeed on that, if everything doesn't come together, and that means, you know, in the face of a media that doesn't particularly treat you seriously or like you very much, you run into the prospect that you might effectively make a lot of people have second thoughts about Joe Biden, but not necessarily vote for you.
All right, here's another clip from Bernie's interview with Rachel Maddow last night.
Senator, I feel like this isn't anything that I've prepared to talk to you about, but I feel like just talking to you here, it's something is sort of becoming clear to me, which is that I feel like your argument for your electability is flawless. It at least is something that resonates with me deeply. I'm a lifelong liberal, and I have always wanted politics both around me locally and in my country broadly to get more to the left. I've always felt that way. And I believe that you are right when you talk about expanding the electorate and when you talk about trying to reach a diverse coalition, particularly people who think that politics don't work for them. But it's not happening in your campaign, and it's not happening more so in your campaign now than it did in 2016.
Rachel,
and
right
I want to know if you have any analysis yourself of why that's not improving.
Let's take a step backwards, okay? If a year ago you had, or anybody else had thought, that somebody is running an unprecedented grassroots campaign which has raised more money for more people than any other candidate in the history of this country, we're taken on Wall Street. You know that today the stock market went way up. The healthcare industry and the drug companies did very, very well today. You know why? Because Biden had a good day yesterday. All right, you're talking to a candidate uniquely who's taken on the entire corporate establishment. You're talking to a candidate who's taking on the political establishment. Mr. Bloomberg comes on board Biden. Other candidates, and he will solidify his support with the political leadership. We're taking that on. We're running a grassroots campaign. This has never been done in the modern history of this country.
You did it in 2016.
No, we didn't. We lost in 2016. We're trying to build. Right now, we have far more support than we had in 2016. So we're trying to do something that is, we're trying to transform this country, not win an election, not just beat Trump. We're trying to break up large banks. We're trying to substantially lower the cost of prescription drugs. We're trying to do what every other major country on earth does, provide health care to all people as a human right. We have introduced the most sweeping and comprehensive climate change proposal ever introduced by a federal candidate, which is why we have the support of the Sunrise Movement and many other environmental organizations. This is tough stuff. So if I came to you and said, hey, you know, I just went to Wall Street. I had a fundraiser down the block. Man, we're raising a lot of money. I got my ads. I hired my consultants. That's what candidates often do. We're doing it differently. And I would be the first to admit that it's hard. The real question is, how do we come this far? Taking on the corporate establishment, taking on the and taking on the corporate media, if I might say so, as well. So I'm pretty proud of what we have accomplished. I'm proud that in the last number of months, we have had thousands of people knocking on millions of doors in this country. This is what needs to happen. I will be the first person to tell you it is hard, okay? I'm not running a conventional campaign. This is, we call our movement Us Not Me. I'm not saying vote for Bernie Sanders, we're gonna solve the problems. We are in this together.
All right. So again, I don't really think that moved her.
Well, and again, I'm going to say I don't think it moved, you know, much of the media. And you see, here's one of the conundrums that I think Sanders should acknowledge at this point. And that is, in 2016, he was running against one candidate. And he got a lot of votes for himself and for his position on the issues. But he also got a lot of votes from people who just didn't like that other candidate, right? He is now in a race against one candidate, right? And so we're going to start to see the test of a lot of his messages and theories about, you know, who he appeals to, how he builds his electorate. And he should acknowledge, I think he should acknowledge right up front, that in many ways this is a test of the system, right? This is a test of our politics. And there are no guarantees. It's not assured that the idea of, you know, running a campaign with small donors, immense amount of money spent on grassroots organizing, getting people to the doors, things like that. Whether that model can work is one that I think you and I have often believed in, a lot of other people do. I suspect that Rachel Maddow believes in it, or at least is interested in it. But this is the test period. And I think that for Sanders, what he did there was he gave, I thought, a very strong, you know, kind of outline of the theory and outline of it. But to my mind, he ought to take it that next step and say, look, you know, we don't know for sure, but we know that to do it this way is the only way we're going to break out of the patterns that we have been in as a country for a very long time.
You know, I thought to myself,
those patterns gave us a lot of things we don't want in our politics.
I thought to myself when the results came in from Alabama and Tennessee and North Carolina and Virginia, South Carolina a couple days earlier, those states and the rate of poverty and people that are uninsured are very high, higher than the national average by far. I was just thinking what universal health care and Medicare for all would do for those states.
And you know what? You know what's like? Here's the interesting thing. In the exit polls from those states, this is a fascinating thing. In the exit polls from those states, people were asked, would you like to replace private insurance with a government-run insurance plan? Like kind of the most, quote-unquote, scary wording possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it won. Across all of those places, across the country.
They didn't vote for Bernie.
Well, here's the important thing. And this is, again, it takes me back to what I've been talking about again and again here. His ideas are winning. They are very, very, very popular. And I think they're popular on two levels. One, intellectually, people know that the economy is transforming. You're not going to get as many benefits from your job. It makes sense. But people know also on a personal level the experience that I had. Somebody, a friend of mine called and said she'd been trying to convince her dad to vote for Bernie Sanders for like the whole campaign. It hadn't been very successful. And then her dad said he voted for Sanders. And she said, why? And he said, well, I heard from my sister the other day, and she's got a heart condition, and she's going to have some surgery. And we were talking about how much it was going to cost, and it suddenly hit me.
Yeah.
I should vote for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, right.
And so the fact of the matter is we have this combination. The reason I will emphasize this, though, is that in those same states, people say, they're asked another question, which is, are you going to vote? Is your highest priority somebody who agrees with you on the issues or somebody who can beat Trump? And again, somebody who can beat Trump wins that by about 2-1, right? And so my core thing to emphasize here is the issues are winning. Sanders is personally quite well liked by a lot of people, but he's got to make a fundamentally deeper connection to electability as an art, to say.
Right.
And if he does that in these next few weeks, my sense is that a lot of the punditry that we're hearing right now could shift.
Yeah. Things are very fluid this year. All right, real quick here as we wrap things up. This is a story about Chuck Schumer and the Supreme Court.
Fireworks at the Supreme Court today. The justices today hearing a key case on abortion rights. It's a big test for President Trump's picks, Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. Outside the court, Senate Majority Leader, Minority Leader, I should point out, Chuck Schumer, with a heated warning.
I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions.
What the hell was he thinking?
What got into him?
Well, seriously. I remember earlier this year, Rachel Maddow did a series of stories on, I don't know, was it Harry Blackmun who made the very prominent writing on the Roe v. Wade decision and all the threats that he got? You don't do that. You don't threaten justices. First of all, there's nothing that's going to happen to them.
You don't threaten people with life terms, and actually, by the way, I mean, of course, that is, that's the objection to many of the things that Trump says about Ginsburg. And so, yeah, I'm not sure that it did Schumer a lot of good, or some of the arguments. The interesting thing was, if you saw it later on, and maybe this is what he should have said there, is that he was, it sounds like he might have been at least quoting or at least referencing some of the things that Kavanaugh said in his testimony, right? Because toward the end of Kavanaugh's testimony, he was talking about, you know, that the tenor of the hearings, right, this whole the process had, you know, kind of unleashed things that might never be put back in the bottle. And if you would simply say, you know, yeah, and if they make these extreme decisions, they are going to unleash attitudes about the courts and, you know, thinking about our judiciary that cannot be put back in the bottle. That
yeah.
People really will have. If a little bit of nuance
a
there might have gone a long way.
A little bit. He sounded like a thug.
Well, be that as it
first of all, don't just call them by their last names. You're not in gym class. You're not calling names out for...
Well, let me offer another notion, though. Let me offer another notion, too. It isn't what Schumer said. Plenty of people will say things like that, including many prominent figures, and it's just going to be part of a rally. It is what John Roberts said back to it, right? And whether you like Roberts or not, when the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court calls you out for your language as regards the court, that's going to hit a lot of middle America. Whether you, again, and should the Chief Justice also call Donald Trump out? Yes.
Well, he has a couple times.
But in a deeper, more fundamental way.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be very
right.
Honest about
well,
that.
It's just, it seems to me that as the Democrats fight to get the majority in the Senate, that doesn't help Chuck Schumer talk about treating a judiciary with a level of independence and dignity that Donald Trump has stepped on.
Bullock thought that was a...
It's not helpful.
Out of Montana. You know, because this is the thing. Yesterday was one of the best days in the life of Chuck Schumer, right? They got Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana. It looks like he's going to run for the Senate seat out there. He's the only Democrat who might be able to win it in a state where Democrats do win Senate seats. And so suddenly, Chuck Schumer is looking at the prospect of winning the Senate. And that is winning the Senate with a pro-choice, pro-social, economic, racial justice majority. It won't be perfect. There's some players who are less committed than others. But it's, you know, pretty big deal. And you can really advance a lot of these issues. You want to make it work. At this point.
Yeah, that's not the way to go about it. All right, we got to wrap it up. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com.
SlysOffice.com.